to do something a little different tonight. I was gonna do something different, and then I changed my mind, and I think I prayed about this. So I don't usually. My plan is not to study what we're reading this year on Wednesday nights, but I haven't fully firmly come up with exactly what I want to do. But I have been studying a little bit, and was earlier as well, about a fellow named Nimrod in the Tower of Babel, and I want to talk about that a little bit. When we were studying Zechariah, it really got me intrigued, talking about the gal in the ephah, and that just really, really, really has made me think and pray and study and so Genesis chapter 10. If you want to turn there tonight. If you remember when we were reading Zechariah, he has a vision of a woman in an ephah, and we talked about an ephah is basically a bigger than, but like a bushel basket, a container of sorts. And you know, it said basically that she was wickedness, and so he took and put the lid on it, and then he put a lead weight on top of it, also something that's measured exactly. And we talked about it. I think she's Mystery Babylon, and according to Revelation, Mystery Babylon is the mother of harlots. And so Babylon, basically the place where all false religion comes from. And I did a little bit more studying and into that, and I ran across an idea that basically says that since it's an ephah that she's in, and since it has a talent weight on top of it, that it has to do with the corruption of measuring stuff. And you measure stuff for selling stuff, and for making money, and for banking, and for business, and for, you know, and it just really got me to thinking about the end time system, the Antichrist, and all of that. But one of the things that, as I'm reading back through the Bible, I'm reading about, first of all, we see that one of the sons of Noah has a curse placed upon him. And that happens because his daddy went and got himself drunk. He planted him a vineyard, and he took the grape juice, which there's nothing wrong with that, but he let it get sour and nasty, and when he should have been throwing it out, he went to drinking on it. Well, he got drunk, and he was laying naked in his tent, and his youngest son walked in on him, and he went running back out and told his brothers, and apparently mocked his father, or, you know, just basically bringing out the fact that he had seen his dad in this place. Well, the other two boys, they walk into the tent backwards with a garment over their shoulders, covering their eyes so they don't see their father, cover him up. And when Noah wakes up and finds out what's happened, he's not real happy about the situation. And he pronounces a curse on his youngest son, on Ham. And actually, the curse jumps Ham to his son. And so, you think about, I mean, it seems kind of harsh. But then, in Genesis chapter 10, we have something that's fascinating, and a lot of people have called it the Table of Nations. And basically what it does is it starts from the time of Noah with his sons, and it accounts who their children are and who they became. And there's nothing like this in all of antiquity. Herodotus isn't able to do this. Xenophon isn't able to do this. Nobody else in all of it. This is the only place in all of ancient writing that basically tells us, and if you take these names and you start following these names through, and the place names and the areas that they went to, you have basically, this is how all the nations of the world scattered out from the time of Noah. But, which is fascinating, and one of the sons of Ham, of course, is a fellow named Cush, and Cush has a kid named Nimrod. And we read about him in Genesis 10. And so it says, the sons of Ramah, Sheba, Dedan. This is verse 7. And then verse 8, it says, and Cush begat Nimrod. He began to be a mighty one in the earth. He was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Wherefore it is said, even as Nimrod, the mighty hunter before the Lord. And the beginning of his kingdom was Babel. Well, that's Babylon. That's where Babylon is going to come from. And Erech and Akkad. Now, if you know anything about history, you know the Tigris-Euphrates River Valley is the Akkadians and the Sumerians. Well, this is where they all come from, right here, from these fellows. And Erech, Akkad, Kelne, and the land of Shinar. Now, Shinar is the place where the woman in the ephah is taken to. And so we got this big circle. Well, what I want to do tonight, I want to get you thinking about that, and then in the next chapter we're going to read about the Tower of Babel, but I want to read a little bit from one of my favorite books. This is Dr. Henry Morris, called The Genesis Record. If you want to study Genesis, I recommend that you get this book, because this is one of the most comprehensive, and if I can understand it, anybody can understand it. He calls it a scientific and devotional commentary on the Book of Beginnings. But Dr. Morris he's a creationist. He is a gentleman. He is, obviously he's a very devout follower of Jesus, but he's just smart. And as we read about Genesis, and as we think about the world that we live in, I just want to read a little bit of this to you. I'm going to jump around a little bit, but I find this fascinating. I think he does a really good job of helping us understand what was happening. So, speaking from Genesis 10, he says, "Although Cush and all his other sons moved south and west into Arabia and Africa, his most illustrious son settled in the Tigris-Euphrates Valley." Now, remember, the ancient enemies of Israel, the conquerors of Israel, the northern tribes are going to be conquered by the Assyrians, which come from the city of Nineveh, which Nimrod established. And then Nebuchadnezzar is going to come from the city of Babylon, which Nimrod established. Okay, so Nimrod is responsible for these ancient cultures. His family is the one, and he's going to gather everybody up. After the flood, he's going to be, he is the strongest world leader in history up to this point, okay? And he is basically going to unite the entire world. Nimrod did something that every leader since then has been trying to do, including Alexander the Great, Donald Trump, and, you know, everybody else since then. He did it. He had them all in one place, basically in one valley, a handful of cities. But he had the hammer on him, okay? And so he says there, apparently remaining there even after the rest of the three Noahic families had been compelled by the confusion of tongues to move away. Nimrod was apparently the youngest son of Cush and perhaps felt something of a moral kinship with his uncle Canaan, who had been the youngest son of Ham and the special designee of the Noahic curse. Now, this is speculation, but listen to this. Cush, as Ham's oldest son, had apparently resented this curse more and more as the years passed by. By the time Nimrod was born, the resentment had become so strong he gave his son a name meaning, "Let us rebel." That's what Nimrod's name means. The inference is that Cush trained Nimrod from childhood to be a leader in a planned and organized rebellion against God's purposes for mankind. Had God destined them to perpetual servitude to the descendants of Shem and Japheth? And that's exactly what the curse says. Cursed be Canaan. He's going to serve Shem. He's going to basically be in servitude to Shem. By the way, that curse is one of the things that British and American slave owners used to justify the ownership of slaves, those who actually knew something about the Bible. They said the black-skinned people are Hamitic, and the white-skinned people are Japhetic, or Shemitic, and Semitic, and so we have the right to rule over them. I hope you realize that that's not right, but anyway, they tried that. So, he apparently named his kid, "Let Us Rebel." They were either from the south, or, you know, they were. Not funny. The inference is that Cush trained Nimrod from childhood. Okay. They would rule instead. And so Cush, perhaps encouraged by Ham and his other sons, began to train Nimrod to struggle for the ascendancy among men. Thus Nimrod began to be a mighty one in the earth. And he soon had all the Hamites and possibly many of the Semites and Japhethites under his influence and leadership. They finally settled the fertile plain of Shinar, a name probably later identified as Sumer, so the Sumerians. And the Sumerians were big time into writing. They used a writing form called cuneiform, which is more ancient than the Egyptian papyrus writings. And they began to build a complex of cities and the beginning of his kingdom of Babel. Nimrod became a mighty hunter in the sense that he was implacable and searching out, persuading men to obey his will. The reference to Nimrod, listen to this, this is really interesting as well. Reference to Nimrod's hunting prowess suggests that wild beasts were thought to be a real source of danger at the time, and that Nimrod acquired a hero's reputation by protecting the population against them. Makes perfect sense. You had dinosaurs still left over that had ridden on the ark. They were roaming the earth. And all these people are living in the city. Now, you know the difference between city people and country people. Country people know how to deal with wild animals. City people are scared of them. So Nimrod, he comes out there, and he, you know, every now and then, he just comes in, packed into a big brontosaurus or something, has a big barbecue for everybody. They're all, ooh, Nimrod, he's a great hunter, you know. But you got to remember this. However, in the context of the first century or two after the flood, it's probable there was a great proliferation of animal populations. Before the flood, less vegetation everywhere. There was an abundance of food for the animals, but the post-flood world was very different. Many of the larger animals particularly may have found it difficult to survive after a time. You get a large animal that's hungry, and he becomes what? Dangerous, right? The fossil record... Yeah, in both the flood sediments and the post-flood or the ice age deposits indicates there were tremendous animals living at the time that might well have been feared as a potentially serious danger to mankind in the early centuries after the flood until they became extinct. Yeah, like woolly mammoths and like big dinosaurs and even creatures like the Irish elk, which is the largest deer species in the world, and you know, huge, 12 foot tall at the shoulders, and saber-toothed tigers and all kinds of really cool stuff that are all gone now. Consequently, a strong man who could hunt and slay such great animals would assume the role of hero and benefactor to mankind that would easily acquire great followers. That there was probably no genuine danger to mankind from animals, however, is evident from God's promise to put the fear and dread of man on all of them. Genesis 9, chapter 2. And to this day, there is a danger from wild animals. But comparative to the other stuff that kills us, it's pretty rare. Because animals are scared of us. And that fear of man perpetuates to this day. So, I thought that was really interesting. Nimrod was a man of great ability and energy. He was evidently the leader of the group that built Babel, which then formed the capital city of the region over which he became king. Though God had instructed men to establish human government systems, he could hardly have intended them to assume the form developed by Nimrod, a great empire comprising a complex of cities centered at Babylon. And yet, that's exactly what the Greeks did. It's exactly what the Romans did. It's exactly what they're trying to do right now today. Centralize the power. So, now we jump over to chapter 11. Chapter 11 is all about the Tower of Babel. Okay? So I'm gonna jump around through this a little bit because this is absolutely fascinating. The 11th chapter of Genesis tells of an event of almost equal importance to that of the Great Flood. The flood was worldwide in its effects, and so was the confusion of tongues of worldwide impact, at least as far as man was concerned. Although the curtain had not been drawn, as it were, on his activities, there can be little doubt that Satan was still energetically working behind the scenes. He pressed his advantage, gained when he capitalized so effectively on the fatal weakness in Ham's character, and soon gained the allegiance of the Hamites in general, and of Nimrod in particular. Romans chapter 1, verses 18 to 32, graphically describes the resulting moral and spiritual deterioration of Nimrod and his followers. Willfully leaving the knowledge and worship of the true God and Creator, they began instead to worship the creation. This soon led to pantheism, polytheism, and idolatry. How much of this new system of religion came by direct communication with Satan himself, we do not know. But there is abundant evidence that all forms of paganism have come originally from the ancient Babylonian religion. The essential identity of the various gods and goddesses of Rome, Greece, India, Egypt, and all other nations with the original pantheon of the Babylonians is well established. Nimrod himself was apparently later deified as the chief god Merodach or Marduk of Babylon. And so what you have in Nimrod is you have a man who is a strong man, who is a leader, he is a builder, and he also realizes that in order to control a large group of people, you need to have control of the religion. And so they begin to build this tower. And so when we talk about, we see in the book of Revelation, when it talks about Mystery Babylon, the mother of harlots, well, the true worship of God is, I mean, we're called, the church, we're called the bride of Christ. Israel of old was called the wife, or the wife of Jehovah. We are a bride still yet in waiting, but she was the bride of Jehovah. And any idolatry is considered by God to be adultery. Anytime his people enter into adultery, enter into idolatry, he considers it adultery. So what you have is you have these two women. You have the true woman, who is the church, and then you've got this harlot, which is all other forms of false religion put out there. Well, this is where it all started, and it didn't take very long. That's what's so amazing, is that Nimrod begins this false religion very quickly. It says, these pagan deities were also identified with stars and planets, the host of heaven, sun-worshipping, occupying a central place. This system was formalized in the zodiac with its numerous constellations. A most remarkable construction, which seems to have been the common possession of all the nations of antiquity. It's fascinating. It doesn't matter where you go. Everybody worships the sun, the stars, the moon. They got these stories, the Native Americans. Go right over here to Paint Rock. You should go see it if you've never seen it. Go see it. They have these rocks stacked up in such a way, and they've got them a turtle painted down there on the rocks. And on June the 22nd at noon, a little dagger of light comes, and it points right straight to the center of that turtle's back. And it, as the sun moves on, it moves back across. Don't tell me these people were dumb. They were very smart. They knew exactly when that took place. And they established that calendar system. But more than that, it's woven into their mythology and their religion. So, he says there, behind this facade of images, both the star charts of the heavens and their stone and metallic representations and temples of men and birds and four-footed beasts and creeping things lurked a real host of the heavens, the angelic and demonic hosts of Lucifer. Many of these rebel angels had already been cast down to hell or Tartarus, delivered into chains of darkness to be reserved unto judgment because of their participation in the attempt to corrupt the human race in the days of Noah, as we read about chapter 6 of Genesis. But a great host remained at liberty to actively oppose the work of God and the people of God. The main thrust of the work of Satan and his host has always been that of deception. He is the one which deceiveth the whole world into worshiping something or someone other than the true God of creation. Satan is notoriously a corrupter rather than an innovator. Think about what's happening in church right now today. We're not trying to do anything new. What we're doing is we're taking church. We've got guys like Rob Bell. He comes out, he plants a church. He's a pastor. And he writes a book, says hell doesn't exist. Right? Love wins, he calls it. You know, this is the work of Satan, this work of corruption. Hence, it's probable the system of paganism with its astrological emblems and complex mythology and mysteries represents a primeval distortion of God's true revelation concerning his creation and promised redemption of the universe. And if you're interested, I can point you to a book that goes back and talks about the zodiac and how this guy thinks, based on the names of the stars, not the images of the stars, because that's ridiculous. I mean, you ever go to the planetarium? Ever go to the planetarium? You know, and they're like, oh, here's Cassiopeia. See, you can see, and this is, and you're going, that don't look like that. That don't look like nothing. That's like that star. The Dipper looks like the Dipper. And the Southern Cross looks like the Southern Cross. And other than that, it don't look like nothing. Well, what this guy says is he says that they named all those stars and that Adam would have used those stars to tell the story of the true God. And over time, that got corrupted. I don't know whether it's right or not, but it's interesting. Here's what I do know. Everybody all over the world uses that story in some way, shape, form, or fashion. Pagan wife. So, not only has the original Babylonian religious system served as a source of all the world's non-Christian religions, but it has also infiltrated and corrupted Christendom to an alarming degree. This has taken place not only in terms of outward ritualism and idolatry, but also in the more insidious philosophy of evolutionary pantheistic humanism, which permeates its educational and political centers. It had been God's command to the sons of Noah that they be fruitful, multiply, and fill the earth. Genesis 9, verse 1. God had ordained the principle of human government. Genesis 9, verse 6. This evidently was to be implemented through subdividing the future population into workable and controllable social units or nations. Each organized national group would thus contribute in its own way to the corporate life of mankind as a whole. Well, they didn't do that. They all stayed in one place under Nimrod's leadership. As a people migrated eastward or southward from the forbidding region of Ararat, they finally came to Shinar in a fertile Mesopotamian plain where they decided to settle and build a city. Perhaps the region reminded them of their antediluvian home, that means before the flood, and they thought that might even be able to restore the conditions of Eden itself, for they named the rivers Tigris and Euphrates after the two streams that had once flowed from the garden. That's interesting too. I never had really thought about it like that. We don't know where the Garden of Eden is, but you know, I've kind of always thought, well, it's probably over there in that valley because of those rivers, the same names. But according to Dr. Morris, those rivers were gone forever after the flood. But in remembrance of that, they might have renamed them. The immediate descendants of Noah, of course, all spoke the same language, the same as had been spoken by men in the antediluvian period. It was probable this was a Semitic language, perhaps even Hebrew, and that would be my vote. I would say everybody spoke Hebrew until after the Tower of Babel. Human speech, okay, he talks about that. I want to see. By this time, Nimrod had evidently attained to the leadership of the people, undoubtedly recognized that their new status with time for specialization and activities other than mere survival would provide the opportunity for either of two future courses of action. One, systematic colonization and development of all parts of the earth, each with its own local government in accordance with God's command. Or two, establishment of a strongly centralized society, which, with controls over resources and occupations, would soon be able to produce a self-sufficient civilization capable of similarly controlling the entire world. Mother Russia. Socialism. Tyranny of any kind. One guy in control, everybody dependent upon the system, localized in cities. Within the last 10 years, the population of the United States has gone to a more urban, more people living in urban environments than live in rural environments. Up until about 10 years ago, more people lived in the country. We're working really, really, really hard right now to do away with the Electoral College. If you do away with the Electoral College, you will be to a situation with Nancy Pelosi or Hillary Clinton running the world in about 2 years. It's about how long it'll take. Because your vote will mean absolutely nothing unless you're in one of those urban centers. And places like New Mexico, they don't count hardly. New Mexico has 4 electoral votes. Did you know that? The entire state of New Mexico gets to vote 4 times for the president. Wyoming, South Dakota, places like that. None of the middle portion of the United States will even count. It'll be all California, the East Coast, and Chicago, Detroit, and Houston. And they'll control, they would control everything. Cities. Listen, there's a city that's coming from God. That's what we look forward to. These cities today, these places are evil. That's Roddy. That's not Bible, but hang in there. All right. So, the traffic's bad. Anyway, there's all kinds of reasons. Let's see, where was I? Evil city. Okay. After establishing the settlement at Babel, Nimrod called a council of the family leaders of the community. Now, this is Henry speculating, but this is fascinating. Nimrod called a council. After discussing the various issues and alternatives, a formal decision was made. Go to, the Hebrew Yahab, usually translated give, probably signifying the pronouncement of a decision. Go to, we shall begin, first of all, to develop a brick-making industry. Good building stones were not conveniently accessible on the river plain, so they make bricks. They don't have stones, so they bake these bricks. Not adobes, they're baked. And then they use bitumen or slime to build these things. And you can go, and Aaron, he's got pictures of it. You can go see it right now today, some of those ancient structures that are made out of baked stones and then put together with asphalt. Very different than Egypt or somewhere else, the buildings that they made in that area. So they decided to do this, naturally growing. This would be no naturally growing haphazard accumulation of dwellings and businesses. This would be a carefully planned urban center. Did you know that there are cities in China that our drones and surveillance are taking pictures of? We don't know what they're for. Entire cities that nobody lives in. Everything totally planned out, sitting out in the middle of the plain. Huge cities, no people. They've got urban centers, they've got residential centers, they've got these places of business, they've got all these streets, they've got electrical laid out, everything, not just laid out, it's functional. Turn the lights on at night, nobody there. You should ask yourself the question, why? That's really expensive. Well, obviously, they're going to migrate. They're gonna put people there for some reason or another. Anyway, so the Great Tower would dominate the city, both architecturally and culturally. It would serve as a focal point of political and religious life of the population, to be a symbol of their unity and strength. Perhaps there was a minority that felt uncomfortable about these grandiose plans. I would hope so. Recalling that God had not given any such instructions and urging Nimrod that it was most important to get about the business of colonizing the entire earth and developing its resources in a manner that would glorify God and not man. It would seem that Noah and Shem, at least, would not have endorsed these plans. But it seems likely their influence would still carry some weight with these first Babylonians. It may even have been Nimrod's colonizing expeditions to Assyria were an attempt to satisfy this minority's opinion, although since Asher was already there with its own settlement, it may be more likely this was an invasion for the very purpose of thwarting independent expansion. Anyway, what he's saying is he's saying that surely there were somebody around that voted against Nimrod's plan, right? I would hope so. But the United States of America, a democratic republic, should really show us that even when you have a large majority of people that are against something, when the people who are at the top of the pyramid want something done, it's fixing them, they're going to push it really, really hard, and they're going to try real hard to make it happen. Well, Nimrod made it happen. Okay, so he talks about this tower. What I want to talk about is the impressive beauty and sacred purpose of the tower would, and the reason of the people, surely please God, and more than compensate for the fact the entire project was contrary to God's command. And did you hear what he said? This is him speculating. I want to read that one more time. The impressive beauty and sacred purpose of the tower would, in the reasonings of the people, surely please God, and more than compensate for the fact that the entire project was contrary to God's commandment, and would glorify human achievement rather than recognize human frailty and divine salvation. But God says to obey is better than sacrifice. Do you know how many buildings there are built all over this world? How many structures? How many paintings? How many idols have been constructed for the glory of God? Surely God would recognize that the expenditure of this money and the beauty of this facade that we have created, you know, David, buck-naked David, and buck-naked Moses, and buck-naked, you know, surely this brings glory to God, right? Anybody ever been somewhere with all them statues? They're all naked. But how could that possibly bring glory to God, right? Surely God would recognize the intent of what we're trying to do here. As we just keep disobeying God, we just get farther and farther and farther away from what God told us to do. He told us, be fruitful, multiply, fill the whole earth. We're going to stay in one spot. Okay? Nimrod, at least, was well aware of what he was doing. However, deceived the people themselves may have been. The tower was completed. And verse 8 suggests they were still building the city when the confusion of tongues took place. But evidently the tower was already in use. Nimrod no doubt instituted religious services there. It was only a short time, however, before the ostensible worship of the Creator was corrupted into the worship of the creature. The grandeur of the tower and the ornateness of its design and furnishings appealed to the flesh. And don't get me wrong, I think church buildings are great. But I literally had someone tell me one time, they said, you know, we just can't worship someplace like you worship. Because it's just a dirty old building. It looks like a barn. I have to be someplace where it feels like I'm close to God. I want you just to think about that. And as I read about Nimrod, and Henry Morris is brilliant. This guy's a genius. But as he's reading between the lines here with a lot of this, this may have been the way this worked. Show me one verse in this book that instructs us on what a quote-unquote religious building is supposed to look like. Isn't it amazing? It's amazing. I could take you to little churches in New Mexico, and they're all built exactly the same. Now, the reason for that probably is they said, well, House has got one that's pretty nice over there. We'll build another one like that at Grady. Or Grady was first, and then House, or whatever. Probably the case. But there probably were some really religious people who were going, you know, this is really how things should be done. And over time, these traditions turn into stuff, and kids ask, why is there a narthex? Anybody know what a narthex is? Well, that's a high church thing. It's a certain part of the building. I mean, they actually have the parts of the building made. Well, where did that come from? Is that in the Bible? No. Anyway, this is the way these things go. It's why it's so absolutely essential. And how many commands did they have, by the way? Was it easy to get bogged down in those days? Be fruitful, multiply, fill the whole earth. And if somebody murders somebody, that person needs to be put to death by the people. That's basically all of the commands that they had right there. And they still completely disobey that. I mean, not just a little bit, but exactly the opposite of what God had said to do. So, let's see. Nimrod, at least, he was aware of this. Not only paintings on the walls, but three-dimensional representations of the men and birds and four-footed beasts and creeping things began to be constructed, not only in the temple, but along the streets and in the homes. These figures, which once had been designated only as symbolic representations on the heavens of the coming Redeemer and of God's great plan of salvation, now begin to take on the aspect of actual spiritual entities. The Virgin, whose sign among the stars once reminded men of the promised seed of the woman, began to assume the proportions of an actual queen of heaven. And Leo, the great sidereal lion at the other end of the zodiac, became a great spiritual king of heaven. Soon, the stars, the physical host of heaven, were invested with the personalities of the angels, the invisible spiritual heavenly host. In acknowledging and worshiping these angelic spirits, the people no doubt felt very pious and religious, for they were merely recognizing the immanence of the omnipresent God of heaven throughout his creation. There were specific angels and stars concerned with every aspect of human life and terrestrial processes. In paying due reverence to these, they were, so they believed, thereby worshiping God. Furthermore, God, through these same spirits and their representative stars, would in response provide protection and provision and guidance in their own lives. Praying to saints. Saint Christopher, protect us. We're going on a journey. Saint so-and-so, the patron saint of all of this and that. I'm talking about, here we are. We are talking thousands of years later in this very thing. You can see it. Prayers to Mary. Prayers to the saints. People wearing magic amulets around their neck. That is, you know, this is Saint so-and-so or Saint so-and-so. The church of the Saint so-and-so or the church of this or that saint. But this system soon became so complicated. Now get this. That it required a specially devoted class of men and women to dedicate their lives to its study and interpretation. so they might guide the people in their devotions and sacrifices and in the ordering of their lives. Furthermore, as the preoccupation of both priests and people with specific localized spirits or local representations of the great universal spirit increased, so did their awareness of the great Father of Spirits decrease. So the more they focus on these things, the less they know about the one true God. As the consciousness of God's personal nearness receded, so did their concern to obey him. But also this absence of true spiritual communion left a spiritual vacuum in their souls, which could only be satisfied by some other kind of personal spiritual communion. This vacuum was soon filled. There were indeed a host of angels in the heavenly places, but vast number of these were fallen angels under the hierarchical control of Satan. God's holy angels were no doubt appalled at these developments in Babel and would have abhorred and repudiated any worship accorded to them by human beings whose servants they had been created to be. But no such inhibition hindered the rebellious angels, the evil spirits of demons. They reveled in it and encouraged it, for all this was in accord with the desire of Lucifer, their master, to become God himself. And as they had done before the flood, these evil spirits began to control the minds and bodies of those human beings who were open to such possession and guidance, especially those of the priests and priestesses who had become devoted to this system of worship. To the innermost circle of these initiates, demonic revelations were given. To some, perhaps to Nimrod and his wife Semiramis, Satan revealed the entire conspiracy against God. From some such beginning soon emerged the entire complex of human religion, an evolutionary pantheism promulgated via a system of astrology and idolatrous polytheism empowered by occultic spiritism and demonism. That's a mouthful right there. There's a lot of isms right there. So, why is this important? Because what the people started to do, you know, some people have said, well, they were building this big tower because they were in rebellion against God because they didn't believe his promise not to flood the earth, and they were all going to run into this tower and keep from being flooded. Well, that's crazy. There's no way they could have done that. That wasn't the purpose of the tower. The purpose of the tower was to show, look at human achievement of man. It's all about man. Look what we can do. Look what we can build. And that's what Nimrod was pushing. Nimrod, the great rebel against God, was basically saying, you know, God cursed my family, and so I'm not going to follow God. I'm going to do my own thing. Whatever God wants me to do, I'm going to do exactly the opposite. And I think we see this, well, I don't think, I know we see this very evident in the world that we live in. How long it was after the construction of the tower before God came down to see the city and the tower, we're not told. It would have been in accord with his nature to have waited as long as possible in hopes that the godly minority there, if there were such, would prevail and the people would repent. They did not repent, however, and God finally came down. So, the problem in the Lord's own judgment lay in the unity of the people, the unity which was made possible only by a common language, the decision by practically the entire population to construct an autonomous, man-centered civilization in direct defiance of God's command could finally be ignored no longer. Furthermore, with Nimrod's presumed knowledge of the satanic mysteries and his access to demonic powers, literally nothing he might decide to do in the future would be beyond his reach. The conditions of the antediluvian world might be repeated, and this God would not allow, even though he had promised Noah he would never again send a worldwide flood. Incidentally, the naive opinion of some of the commentators talks about building the tower to get out of the flood. So we have this big rebellion from Nimrod. And it's always amazed me as I read that passage in Genesis 11 that God comes down, has a conference with the Son and the Holy Spirit, and basically says, whatever they decide to do, they can do. Now think about what the world that we live in today. Think about how more unified we are. Now we're not unified as far as getting along with each other. But think about how small the world is today. I have an app on my phone that I can talk with somebody who speaks another language. We are able to communicate at a
much higher rate. I can get on here and have FaceTime with somebody on the other side of the planet right now today. I can jump on a plane within 24 hours. I can be anywhere on the planet that I would like to be. The world keeps getting smaller and smaller and smaller. And so something that God, when he confounded those languages, God bought a whole bunch of time. But that time, that the ability to bring all of mankind together is so much stronger today. And as you go, especially like you go to the movies, don't go to the movies, I don't recommend going to the movies, there's nothing good to watch. But if you happen to go, watch the commercials beforehand. Goodness gracious. You know, these big, huge corporations like Coca-Cola and Apple, man, they are pushing worldwide unity so much. And you can really see it when you go to some bastion of liberalism like the cinema. You see that kind of stuff. The Super Bowl's coming up. Get ready. You know, it's the best part of the Super Bowl. Turn the halftime show off, please. But, watch the commercials. Usually the beer commercials are pretty good. But you're gonna see this. Isn't it something? You're gonna see this push toward we've all gotta get along. And what is it that constantly gets in the way of everybody getting along? Those pesky Christians. Because they're so filled with hate. You know, they can't just roll over and die, which is what the whole world wants for us to do. They always have to speak up about these things that cause division, right? Well, I just can see it. I mean, it just really jumps out at me. Anyway, real quickly. Okay, this is also really fascinating too. I am not archaeology is cool when it's really good, but you know what archaeologists do? They go dig through somebody's trash and then try to tell you everything about them, okay? And if you were to come dig through my trash and then try to tell me everything about me, I'm pretty sure you'd get some stuff wrong. But I want you to listen to this, okay? So God confounds the languages. When he confounds the languages, people can't get along and they start scattering, which was his original intent. Wanted him to go all over the world. His population grew, and this was rapid progress. His longevity was still high, and it was advantageous for each family to have many children. Geographic expansion, likewise, was rapid. The stronger, more industrious, and intelligent tribes took and held more favorable regions with resulting greater resources. They soon became great nations. The weaker, less ambitious families were pushed further and further away from the great centers of civilization, being forced to colonize new regions altogether before they could set about to establish their own particular culture. This process of migration. Now, if you were to talk to an anthropologist today, and they would tell you, you know, we've studied language and we've studied genetics and all of this, and, you know, the Native American, indigenous Native Americans are kin to the Indo-Europeans and to the, you know, the Chinese, and how did they get here, you know? Well, they had to come across on, you know, that land bridge, well, probably before the glaciers melted, the Bering Strait, there was probably a land bridge between Alaska. They could have walked over here. They could have also built a sailing vessel because they were highly intelligent people, smarter than us probably, and they sailed all over the world. And there's also the chance that maybe there was one giant continent that actually the tectonic plates shifted, maybe. But there's all kinds of answers to that question. It's not this massive mystery like when you go to the museum and they make it out to be such an incredible mystery. The process of migration and cultural development did not require long ages, as evolutionists imagine. Rather, the entire world was inhabited within a few generations at most. Increasingly, in recent years, as archaeology has been confirming that civilization appeared more or less contemporaneously in all parts of the world only a few millennia ago. He's saying that's what evolutionary archaeology says, that it basically just whoop, all over the world there's population, you know, several thousand years, millennia, thousands of years ago. A similar pattern of cultural development seems to have occurred over and over again. Now listen to this. This is what I explained this to a science teacher when I was in high school, and they just looked at me like I was crazy because I told them that there are cavemen today. I can take you to Mexico and show you people who live in caves right now today. So this idea, you know, the Flintstones is cool, so are the Jetsons, neither one of them are going to happen or ever did, okay? So there's no such thing as cavemen, but a similar pattern of cultural development seems to have occurred over and over again. As a tribe migrated to an unexplored region, it would find a suitable location, most commonly on a high elevation for protection, near a spring or river with fertile alluvial plains for water and food supply, and then try to establish a village. Right? So it's like the oil field. You get a job, you move there, you don't have a permanent dwelling. So what do? You rent somebody's couch, you live in somebody's garage, you park your RV down the street and empty the sewer into the city sewer. You know, whatever. You do whatever it takes, right? That's what they did. They tried to establish a village. Although members of the tribe certainly knew many useful arts, such as agriculture, animal husbandry, ceramics, metallurgy, and so on, they could not use them right away. Veins of metal had to be discovered, mined, and smelted. Suitable clay muds had to be found for making bricks and pottery. Animals had to be bred. Crops had to be planted. All of this would take several years. In the meantime, the tribe had to survive by hunting, fishing, gathering fruits and nuts. Temporary homes had to be built of stone, if available, or timber, or even live in caves. They did it over and over and over again. They did it when they moved out west here. I'd take you to a half dugout across the highway from my dad's that's just barely much more than a cave, you know? And so when they find these, oh, these were cave people. Don't think Cro-Magnon sloping forehead. I mean, they could. I mean, I'm built like that. They could have been ugly, okay? I'm not saying some of them weren't ugly. But the whole idea that there was this caveman mentality, you know, God scattered them all over the world, and as they scattered, they had to establish themselves, and it takes time to establish themselves. Just because you know how to smelt iron doesn't mean that you can do it for several years. You're going to have to, you got to build. You know, have you ever thought about this? I think about this all the time with hand tools. You know, a hammer is a really, really handy thing to have. But it takes a hammer to build a hammer, right? So when you start from scratch, you gotta build your forge, and you gotta forge some tools. And then, you know, you bring some tools with you, but in a war or crossing the river, you drop them, they don't float. You get where you're going, and you gotta start from scratch, and you gotta use a really crude thing to develop a better thing, and over time to make that thing better and make that thing better. And then it's got to rain, and your crops have to make, and if it doesn't, and you have to move, or the people invade. And so, cavemen, sure, right now today. We got people living down here under a bridge right now today. So this is actually a whole lot closer to the way that the scattering out of people took place. Remains of these original occupation sites naturally suggest to evolutionists a Stone Age culture. But actually, they reflect only a very temporary situation. As soon as materials for ceramics and metals could be found, the Stone Age at the site was succeeded by a Bronze Age or an Iron Age. The village economy was quickly succeeded by urbanization, and the population increased, and suitable building materials were developed. All you have to do is look at the westward expansion of Texas, and you can see exactly the same thing happen. When those Indians stole that little girl from that fort, there was a fort that was made out of wood poles that they had built. There wasn't no fancy Austin Capitol till just a few years ago, right? So it takes time to get fancy and civilized. All right, but not millions of years time. Not infrequently, particularly if the site was especially desirable, a subsequent invasion by a stronger tribe would drive out or destroy the occupants, and a distinctively different culture would succeed the original one on that site. Some of the tribes grew rapidly, developed strong nations, others grew slowly, stagnated, deteriorated, and finally died out. As each family and tribal unit migrated away from Babel, not only did they develop a distinctive culture, but they also developed distinctive physical and biological characteristics. Where did black folks come from? Okay? Since they could communicate only with members of their own family unit, there was no further, or where did white folks come from? Maybe Adam was black and the white folks are, you know, the branch off of that. I don't know. It doesn't matter. But what's that?
Chronic disease.
No, it's not a disease. Hence, it was necessary to establish new families composed of very close relatives for several generations at least. So think about it. If when God confounded the languages, if he kept families together, I
I want to think that he did, at least to some degree. It would be really tough if Aaron, Kayla, and all of their children showed up speaking five different languages one day. That would be really, really hard. Now, Aaron and Kayla speak one language, the children speak a different language, but they're learning to communicate. That would be even harder. I mean, that wouldn't be quite as hard. It'd still be really hard. But if God left family units together, then as they begin to break off and maintain those family units, and I want to think that's the way God did it. So listen to this. It is well established genetically that variations take place very quickly in a small inbreeding population, but only very slowly in large inbreeding populations. Now, we've learned this with cattle and with horses, especially with horses. Right now today, the thoroughbred world would love to find somebody that can outrun the one or two horses they have that can really run. But their problem is that they spent so many years inbreeding that they don't have any new genes. And they just can't, they can't do it. They've painted themselves into a corner. The quarter horse world is almost just as bad. But if you start what's called line breeding, you can get certain genetic characteristics to show up very quickly that won't show up as quickly in a larger population. So when you've got this huge group of people and people are intermarrying across this, you've got all kinds of genes that are there that don't show, because dominant genes are the ones that are always going to show up. So he says, in the large interbreeding population, only the dominant genes will find the common expression in the outward physical characteristics of the population, reflecting more or less average characteristics. Even though, man, you just can't believe. Maybe you can if you've been there. I went to Moscow. I get off the plane in Moscow, I'm thinking, you know, because I've been a few other places in the world, been to Mexico and places like that. I stick out like a sore thumb in Mexico, and I'm going, finally, I'm going to be somewhere where I don't stick out like a sore thumb. Wrong. Stick out like a sore thumb. Russian people do not look like American people. And when I got out in the midst of them, I went to looking around, I'm like, whew, just because you call yourself Caucasian, facial features are different, different, certainly different mannerisms, the posture is different. It's really interesting. And so you see these certain things that grow over a period of time. So he says here, in a small population, the particular suite of genes that may be present in its members, though recessive in the larger population, will have opportunity to become openly expressed and even dominant under these circumstances. Thus, in a very few generations of such inbreeding, distinctive characteristics of skin color, height, hair texture, facial features, temperament, environmental adjustment, and others could come to be associated with particular tribes and nations. When you break off small families and those families begin to marry and by the way, it's not until the time of Moses that God tells people that they're not to intermarry into their own families anymore. At that point in time, you had very little, I think the reason for that is you had very little mutations based on free radicals from the sun, and you just didn't have near as many. You had a pure gene pool for several thousand years. And once the law of Moses comes, God says, don't marry your sister anymore. But up until that point in time, Adam's sons, they had no choice because there were no other human beings. So they would have intermarried. Abraham was married to his half-sister, and so was his brother. And so you see that as these families, God confounds their languages, they branch off because of their languages. They branch off and they begin to develop from their family recessive genes that they didn't even know were present. All of a sudden begin to manifest themselves, and that particular family begins to be very distinct from another one that wouldn't have happened nearly as quickly if they had been in the larger population. So the question, how come some people's skin color very dark? Why do certain people have more fat deposits around their eyes, and they're located in certain parts of the world so that you could look at somebody from Far East Asia and you would see the eye and you would see a particular skin color to them. Why does that happen? Why do we look so much differently? Our ancestors looked at people from Africa and said they were animals. They said that they were not fully human because they had a different skin color and a different hair texture. And sometimes because of the primitive circumstances that they found them in, and they justified slavery because of that as well. They wove it back into this idea of the curse on the Hamitic peoples, and they said, manifest destiny says we're supposed to take over the world, and you people are going to work for us. And some people justified that, but it's not true. The curse on Ham, some people have taught that that curse was to turn Ham black, and or Canaan. Canaan would have been black, and then all the black folks were because of that curse. Please don't believe that. And if somebody ever says that, please set them straight. That's not true. It's not right. The Tower of Babel, when God confounded the languages and people began to move apart from each other, those particular distinctives begin to show. And you know, did you know that the largest incidence of skin cancer on the planet, you know where it is? It's in Australia. Because the British sent all their prisoners down there to that island to get rid of them, and they're all fair-skinned folks. And those fair-skinned folks lived in the midst of a group of what they call Aboriginal people who are very dark-skinned and get along great at that latitude. But those white-skinned people down there, the sun bakes them, and they've got a higher incidence of skin cancer than anybody else on the planet because all of those genetic traits came from Europe. And the people that actually settled down there developed really nicely for that. And the closer you get to the equator, the darker skin has to be, or you'll roast and you'll die. And if it's just this real small little family and you go move down there on the equator, you better be in the hat making business and figure out how to rub some mud on you, or else it's going to kill you, except for that one kid who has more melatonin in their skin than everybody else, and he does well. And then those genes begin to perpetuate. And as those genes perpetuate, that group of people has much darker skin than the people that they came from. And it's fascinating as you study that. So I wanted to, I'm sorry for reading so much tonight, but I just thought that was really good. The way he's much better at explaining things than I ever will be. All false religion goes back to Babylon, every bit of it. And it doesn't matter where you go on the planet, whether you go into some aboriginal tribe and you see their spiritism and their ancestor worship. And ancestor worship is where Nimrod came from. Nimrod became a hero, and then the people began to worship the man. And after he was long dead, they had written his name in the stars, and they were still worshiping him. And cultures all over the world, those same, they changed the names a little bit, and they changed certain things about it. But that system of Babylonian worship, it is alive and well in San Angelo, Texas, right now today. And the bottom line is this. Here's the whole summary. Our worship must be based on God's instruction. Our obedience must be based on God's instruction. We don't get innovative when it comes to obeying God. We don't go, because who was the great innovator in worship besides Nimrod? Who was the earliest innovator? Who was the obeyer and who was the innovator? God, Abel, that's right. Abel obeyed, Cain innovated. Which one did God like? The obedience. He didn't want the innovation. I didn't tell you to bring those vegetables. Those are nice vegetables. Good job. That doesn't count. Go trade Abel some of your vegetables, buy some of his lambs, and come bring me the firstlings of the flock and the fat portions thereof, and I'll accept it. And Cain said, no! Not going to do it. You're going to do it my way, and I hate my brother for obeying God. And it continues. Nimrod was exactly the same way. Ahab was exactly the same way. Ahab went off and married old Jezebel, and she was a Phoenician princess, and she came in and she brought the worship of Baal, and she batted those eyes. She painted up her eyes. You know, she was going to get old Jehu, but Jehu was smarter. She painted up those eyes and she said, oh, Ahab, my God's so much better than yours. And he said, okay. She led him around the field. God told Solomon, he said, don't you marry those foreign women because they'll lead you astray to worship those false gods. That's exactly what happened with old Ahab and all those northern kings. Read your Bible. Take what you read in the Bible, put it into practice in your life. If you don't, what's going to happen is you're going to dream something up, and you're going to go build a Taj Mahal to God, and then you're going to be standing there going, now why isn't God pleased with this? Because God didn't tell you to do that. God told us to come to Him through Jesus.